morning, colleagues, ladies, and gentlemen. Welcome to the meeting of the Orange County Housing and Community Development Commission for Thursday, April 23rd, 2026. And if you'll join me to pledge allegiance to that great nation. Ready to begin.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, we'll now proceed with the agenda for this morning's meeting. The agenda contains a brief general description for each item that we're going to consider. Except for otherwise it's provided by law, no action will be taken on anything that's not on the agenda. Public rights, or I'll talk about public comment. Public comment rights are not limited and do not include the right to defame or slander. The use of profanity that cause or disturbance or disruption of the meeting and is truly objectionable is not allowed, and it may cause us to have to recess the meeting. Public comments must be within the subject jurisdiction of the commission. As such, attacks on persons who are not subject to the jurisdiction of the commission will not be heard. If a speaker makes comments that are not focused on the agenda item or matters within the body's jurisdiction, the speaker will be warned to confine their comments to the relevant topics. Informal action may be taken, including but not limited to terminating the speaker's remaining public comment time and removing the speaker from the meeting. All remarks and questions shall be addressed to the commission as a whole and not to any individual commission member. No question shall be asked of any commission or staff member without first obtaining permission from the chair. Each person who addresses the commission shall refrain from making personal, impertinent, slanderous, or profane remarks to any member of the commission, staff, or general public. Any person who makes such remarks or who utters loud, threatening, personal, abusive language or engages in any disorderly conduct which disrupts, disturbs, or otherwise impedes the orderly conduct of the commission meeting shall, at the end of the direction of the chair or the majority of the members, be ruled out of order and directed to end the remarks and be seated. If such conduct, therefore, continues to disrupt the order, the orderly conduct of the public's business, the chair shall order the person removed from the meeting. Aggravated cases may be prosecuted on appropriate complaint signed by the chair and member of the commission or other county representative. So we haven't ever experienced that, but that's what we have in place. Okay, so Madam Clerk, will you please call the roll?
Yes, good morning. Mr. Fatboy? Second call for Mr. Boyd. Ms. Tracy Law?
Here.
Thank you. Mr. Mike Alvarez?
Here.
Thank you. Ms. Carrie Buck?
Here.
Thank you. Stephanie Otto? Second call for, I'm sorry, Ms. Stephanie Otto's excused today, I apologize. Dr. Tiffany Mitchell?
Here.
Thank you. Mr. Wayne Carvalho?
Here.
Ms. Carla Wilkerson?
Here.
Ms. Helen Smith-Gardner? And second call for Ms. Helen Smith-Gardner. Mr. Mike Frost?
Here.
And Ms. Cecilia Hupp?
Here.
And I'm going to recall one more name. Mr. Fatboy?
Yes.
Thank you. He's present. Madam Chair, we have quorum, and I'd like to announce some housekeeping items before we begin. Please note that if a quorum is lost due to members leaving early or other reasons, the chair should promptly end the meeting. If you wish to comment on a specific agenda item in person, please complete the speaker request forms identifying the number, your name, and deposit the completed form in the box located next to the clerk to speak on a matter not appearing in the agenda but under the jurisdiction of the agency decommission. You may do so during public comment item. Speaker request forms must be deposited prior to the beginning of the consent calendar, the reading of the individual agenda items, the opening of the public hearing, and or the beginning of public comment item. When your name is called, please come to the podium and begin your comment by stating your name or pseudonym for the record. Members of the public desiring to speak should address all remarks and questions to the commission. Speakers may address the commission up to three occasions with 3 minutes allotted to the speaker per occasion.
All right, so our next item would be the approval of the minutes. If I could have a motion and a second.
I'll make the motion.
Second.
Okay, Mrs. Sepp and Mr. Boyd. For this, Madam Clerk, have you received any public comments?
Chair, no requests have been received for the approval of the minutes.
With that, we'll take a vote. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries unanimously. So we do not have any presentations or introductions today. Do we have any public comment?
Madam Chair, we have no requests for public comments.
All right. Okay, so we have no items, no public hearing items as well. Did I go too far?
Yeah, consent calendar.
Oh, one back page. Sorry, discussion item number eight. We have no consent items today. We're only going to have one discussion item, and it's our Brown Act training presentation for the commission members. And let's see, we have John Cleveland, our senior deputy county counsel, will be here to help us. And Chair, or is there any public comment from this as well?
At the moment, we have no request on discussion calendar items.
Did I skip over the discussion calendar? No, okay, we're on the Brown Act. Okay, so with that, can I have a motion? We want to start with a motion in a second, and then we'll have the presentation or presentation first?
Presentation.
Okay, so we'll start with the presentation.
Hey, good morning. My name is John Cleveland. I'm here to give you a Brown Act refresher for many of you. This will be a review. We're going to talk about the Brown Act definitions and basic rules, rules regarding standing in ad hoc committees, frequently asked questions, public participation, public's access to documents, the new SB 707 changes to the Brown Act, certain teleconferencing rules associated with SB 707, and finally, violations and enforcement. So the Brown Act is designed to ensure public participation in open and public meetings. It ensures that items to be discussed, acted upon, or deliberated about during a public meeting are properly agendized before action is taken, and it calls for agendas to be posted at least 72 hours prior to regular meetings. Again, the basic rules to ensure that meetings are open to the public and to avoid the misuse of the government process and ensure open and open deliberations. There are certain key concepts and definitions that apply to the Brown Act and determine when or when it is not applicable. The first is legislative body, the second is local agency. A commission or advisory body such as your commission is governed by the Brown Act. And standing committees of legislative bodies are subject to the Brown Act when they have continuing subject matter jurisdiction or a meeting set by a charter, ordinance, resolution, or any formal action of that legislative body. Here's a quick question that comes up frequently. Is a standing committee comprised of less than a quorum of the governing body subject to the Brown Act? The answer is yes, if it has continuing subject matter jurisdiction or a meeting schedule fixed by formal action of that body. Standing committees, even if less than a quorum, are essentially treated as extensions of the legislative body itself, and they're subject to the Brown Act. There is, however, an exception for ad hoc or temporary committee meetings. Ad hoc committee meetings must meet certain criteria to qualify for this exception. They must serve a limited single purpose. They must not be perpetual, and they must be dissolved once their specific task is completed. Here's another question for you. If the legislative body creates an ad hoc committee and states that the ad hoc will not have continuing subject matter jurisdiction, but the ad hoc actually ends up exercising continuing subject matter jurisdiction, is it subject to the Brown Act? And the answer is yes. Substance controls over form. You have to be aware of kind of scope creep or slip and dissolve ad hoc or temporary committees as soon as their mission is completed. So another defined term that determines whether the Brown Act applies or not is the term meeting. This is a congregation of a majority of the members of the legislative body at the same time, place, and location to discuss matters within the subject matter jurisdiction of the body. And it's important to note that the term actually includes to hear, discuss, or deliberate, or take action. If any of those verbs take place when there's a majority present, you may have a defined term meeting under the Brown Act, and the Brown Act may apply. This includes meetings such as ceremonial, well, not ceremonial occasions, but meals, social events, and situations where those aren't necessarily even taken. So it's important to be careful that you don't have an inadvertent meeting during a lunch or something like that. Serial meetings are also prohibited, and this can take place in a daisy chain or a hub and spoke scenario where an individual passes on the positions or helps facilitate a series of deliberations among members, even if they are all not physically present during the meeting. However, one-way briefings from staff to individual legislative body members are permitted, and communications from county council to members of the legislative body are not meetings under the Brown Act. So here's a quick question. Are commission members limited regarding the items they can or can't discuss over email, text, or social media? The answer is yes, and this is specifically provided for in the code. The Brown Act prohibits a use of serial communications that includes emails, texts, or social media to discuss, deliberate, or take action on any item of business within the subject matter jurisdiction of the body. For example, if a member likes a social media post of another member of the same body, that could violate the Brown Act. Similarly, participating in a internet chat room, a blog dialogue, or any other online platform could potentially violate the Brown Act. And here's a quick quiz for you. Which of these communications could violate the Brown Act? Replying all to an email message, discussing an issue in the internet chat room, posting a like on a social media platform, discussing an issue on a platform that features messages that temporarily disappear, or deploying a digital surrogate to advocate on issues within the subject matter jurisdiction of the legislative body. And the answer, of course, is all. All of these things could be a problem. There are, however, six narrow exceptions to the definition of meeting. This slide's for awareness, and I'd encourage you to consult with staff and county council if you think any of the exceptions apply. All six of these exceptions are predicated on members of the legislative body not using the exception as an opportunity to discuss or deliberate on items within the subject matter jurisdiction of the legislative body. There's an exception for individual contacts or conversations between a member of the legislative body and any other person. That's similar to the one-way briefing exception that we discussed previously. An exception for conferences that are open to the public that address issues of general interest to the public. Attendance at community meetings that are open to the public. Attendance at open and notice meetings of another local agency. Attendance at purely social or ceremonial occasions such as weddings, funerals, or farewells. And finally, an exception for open and notice standing committee meetings, provided the members don't actually participate in that standing committee meeting, but instead are just observers and members of the audience. So let's talk a little bit about agenda notice requirements. Every meeting must have an agenda that is posted in a place that is accessible to the public at least 72 hours in advance. It must state the time and the place for the meeting. And each agenda must state a brief general description of each item to be discussed or transacted. And except as otherwise provided by law, no action or discussion shall be undertaken on any item not appearing on the posted agenda. This is an important rule because it's tempting to want to try and do as much business as possible at each public meeting, but if something hasn't been agendized, the proper course is to actually ask for the item that has not yet been agendized to be agendized at a future meeting and wait to discuss or deliberate or take action until that future meeting. There are different notice rules for special meetings. Special meetings come up on a limited basis, and a presiding officer or majority of the legislative body may call that special meeting by posting the agenda 24 hours in advance. the call and the notice similarly discusses the items to be discussed or transacted, and no other business may be conducted at that special meeting than what is on the agenda. Just for your awareness, there are emergency meetings. Emergency meetings require even less notice, but telephonic notice is required. Let's talk a little bit about the public's right to document. So the public has a right to all the documents that are considered by a majority of the members of the legislative body, and a couple different timeframes apply depending on who creates the document and when it's made available to the legislative body. So if it's more than 72 hours before a meeting and a majority of the members receive those materials, the materials must be made available to the public in a place that's similar to where the agenda is posted. If members of the legislative body prepare the materials and they're made available to members of the legislative body during the meeting, the public must have access to the materials during the meeting. However, if someone outside of the local agency prepared the materials and distributed to them during the meeting, then the public must have access to those materials after the meeting. And this final rule is important. If the legislative body members receive the materials less than 72 hours before a regular meeting, then the materials must be made available to the public at that same time they're distributed to members of the legislative body. This can be a little bit tricky if for some reason it's less than 72 hours before a meeting and staff want to get the materials out to the members of the legislative body right away, but it's a weekend and it can't be made available. The best course is to hold off on distributing the materials to the members of the legislative body until they can also be made available at the same time to members of the public, so there isn't a potential for some sort of unfair information provision, the legislative body getting the materials longer than the members of the public. So let's talk about SB 707. There's been a lot of headlines about SB 707 and how it changed the Brown Act this year. But there's really two categories of changes. There's changes for eligible legislative bodies, such as the Board of Supervisors or maybe the City Council, and then there's changes that apply to all legislative bodies, including those that are classified as not eligible legislative bodies, such as advisory commissions, such as your own. And the changes that apply to advisory commissions are actually somewhat minimal. SB 707 recast the old teleconferencing provisions from AB 361 and AB 2449 and added certain teleconferencing options, such as the ability of a member to participate in meetings remotely as a reasonable accommodation for disability. And we're going to talk a little bit more about those details in the coming slides. For advisory commissions, there is a requirement to provide you with a copy of the Brown Act, and if you haven't been provided with a copy this year, you'll get one following this meeting. There are provisions, like I said, for teleconferencing due to a disability. There's reorganization of the old teleconferencing rules, and there's clarification that people participating through teleconferencing can in fact be muted, and that public meetings are able to be recorded. So let's talk about teleconferencing for a member with a disability. A member with a disability is now allowed by code to participate remotely. Their participation does count for quorum. They participate via two-way audio-visual technology, and the member is entitled to disclose before any action is taken whether any adults are present in the room and their relationship to those individuals. The old teleconferencing rules for just cause and emergency circumstances have been rewritten and recast. However, the substance remains largely the same. There's also the continued teleconferencing meetings under the traditional Brown Act rules. On the coming slides, we're going to talk about the notice requirements, public access requirements, and details for the traditional teleconferencing rules, teleconferencing under disability, and teleconferencing under a state of emergency, and teleconferencing under just cause. and a new category for teleconferencing for eligible subsidiary bodies if approved by the Board of Supervisors. So each of these charts go over the teleconferencing rules that we just discussed. I'm not going to read the slides to you, but I want you to be aware of each of these provisions, and we'll talk about a couple of key requirements under the teleconferencing rules for each. So this is the old teleconferencing rule. It's still there. Anyone can teleconference if they post a sign outside of their hotel room and allow members of the public to participate at their hotel room or their home. It's very cumbersome. It's rarely used. However, it has been used by a member of our Board of Supervisors in the past. These are the details for teleconferencing for members with a disability. Again, it's important to note that the member with a disability counts towards quorum. The public does not get access to that member's location, but the members need to be able to participate at the meeting location that's taking place physically within the county. Here are the rules for teleconferencing under a state of emergency. Of course, if there is a declared state of emergency, members of the legislative body don't need to attend in person, but the findings need to be repeated every 45 days. You may recall kind of that repeat finding scenario during COVID. The agenda must include teleconferencing details so members of the public can participate remotely at those emergency teleconferencing meetings. The public needs to have access either via telephone or internet-based option. Here are the recast, recodified, just cause teleconferencing rules. As a reminder, there's teleconferencing allowed for caregiving, illness, official travel, military service. The minutes must describe the basis for that teleconferencing. And in-person quorum is required, so there must still be a physical quorum at the notice location. The frequency limits are pretty limited, 2 meetings per year if the legislative body regularly meets once per month, and the public again needs to have access to the primary physical location. So this is the new category, eligible subsidiary body. The code now allows for the Board of Supervisors, in this case, to approve and make certain findings if certain conditions are met for eligible subsidiary bodies. That allows eligible subsidiary bodies to hold their meetings via teleconferencing. So first you have a definition of eligible subsidiary body, which basically is an advisory body that doesn't have primary subject matter jurisdiction over sensitive issues like approval of contracts or licenses, permits, things like that. And then the parent body that created it, again, the Board of Supervisors, needs to make certain findings every 6 months. Those findings include things like finding that the teleconferencing remote meeting would enhance public participation and retention of qualified members for that legislative body. The agenda must specify the teleconferencing option and the basis for the approval, and the eligible subsidiary body must post the agenda at a physical meeting location, but not post the agenda at a remote location. So SB 707 also clarified removal. If under any of these teleconferencing options that we just discussed, someone is creating a disruption, just as they might during a physical meeting, that individual may be muted or removed from the electronic meeting. And SB 707 also clarified that anyone can come to a meeting and record it as long as there's no disruption. And that concludes SB 707. Let's move on to public participation rules and for open public meetings. Regular and open public meetings must be properly agendized. Secret ballots are not allowed. Every agenda must discuss the items to be acted upon. But a common question comes up is, when can members discuss items that are not on the agenda, and if so, are there any limitations? As a general rule, a legislative body may not discuss any item that doesn't appear on the agenda. but staff may briefly respond to statements or questions posed by persons exercising their public testimony rights. Additionally, they may make announcements or brief reports on their own activities, and members of the legislative body may provide a reference to staff or other resources for factual information, request staff report back to the body at a subsequent meeting, direct staff to place a matter of business on a future agenda. And who enforces the Brown Act? Well, under California law, the district attorney or any interested person may enforce the Brown Act. And that may be done through a writ of mandate, a civil lawsuit to seek an injunction or declaratory relief. The actions are typically designed to stop or prevent violations or threaten violations or address past violations by members of the legislative body. There are specific requirements for responding to a demand that a legislative or an allegation that a legislative body has violated the Brown Act or taken improper action. There are detailed rules regarding when you need to respond, how you can respond, and when the allegations of a violation need to be made. And I'd encourage you to work with staff and county council if you encounter any such claims or allegations. This is a recap slide that basically reiterates that actions to enforce the Brown Act may be taken by the TA or any interested person. And attorney's fees and court costs can be awarded to a prevailing plaintiff. That can be a significant cost, and it definitely is an incentive to make sure that everyone is working within the boundaries of the Brown Act. Again, there's actions to invalidate under the Brown Act, actions to determine whether a past action constitutes the violation, and actions to prevent future violations. And each of these have specific requirements and details. Finally, there's criminal enforcement that's a potential if there is an intent to deprive members of the public of information which the member knows or has reason to know the public has a right to know. That concludes my presentation. If you have any questions, please let me know. If you'd like to discuss any sensitive matters, I'm happy to meet with you outside of this meeting.
Anybody have any questions, comments? Okay, could I have a motion and a second, please?
I'll make the motion.
I'll second. We have a motion and a second.
Thank you, John.
I'm by John. Here. And did you say, was it Dr. Mitchell?
Yes.
Okay, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Okay, we have no public hearings today, and so that next brings us to reports of staff and our commission members. So we're going to start with reports of staff first. And would you like to introduce?
Yeah, so this morning Orange County Housing Authority update is being given by Rebecca Ricketts. January had another engagement. So Rebecca, go ahead.
Thank you. Morning, everybody. I'm Rebecca Ricketts. I'm the section chief for the special housing program. I'm stepping in for January, who's not available this morning. She asked me to give an update specifically on special housing programs. I'm happy to address other OCHA-related topics as well. I'll specifically be talking about the FUP and FYI programs and the VASH program. We received flat funding for those programs, but we are encouraged by HUD to maximize our current voucher allocation. We currently have for FUP and FYI 375 vouchers. So FUP and FYI include target populations for both youth and families connected with foster care, social services. Of those 375 vouchers, we do currently have 99 targeting youth, and we're working to increase our utilization so that we can ask for an additional 25 vouchers. We anticipate asking for those in the coming months. We're currently at 88% utilization, and we're required to be at 90% to ask for an additional allocation. Take questions at the end, if that's okay. And then for our VASH, we currently have 1,089 vouchers allocated to OSHA. We currently have two available of those, so an additional allocation is critical in order to be able to continue to issue vouchers. We requested 30 additional vouchers from HUD, and we expect to get that award shortly. Of those BASH vouchers, 913 are tenant-based vouchers, and 176 are dedicated to project-based vouchers for veterans. And that concludes my update.
I do have a question. I missed what you said. What percentage are we at for utilization?
And you are?
Sorry, this is Commissioner Mitchell. What utilization rate are we at for the FYI vouchers?
We're at 88%
currently. And we need to be at 90% for plus more.
Right, exactly.
Are there any vouchers that are in circulation now that are, so the ones that are unassigned are, how many unassigned FYI vouchers do we have?
We have zero unassigned.
Okay.
So they're all issued and out searching. So we're just waiting for those new leases to be executed.
Okay.
And we've been at 100% utilization, they all lease up.
Okay.
This is Chair Buck. Can you explain more or share more a little bit about the timeline or how long they've been searching and what sort of assistance do they get? What connections do they get to have that voucher?
Sure. Specifically for the youth?
For the youth.
So the youth those referrals come from social services, and they're connected with Orangewood Foundation to provide those 3 years of housing placement, housing stabilization services. So that begins right at the beginning. As soon as we receive the referral, that youth is given opportunity with an Orangewood caseworker. They assist with completing the application, the housing search, the management of the property manager. We issue the vouchers within 45 days of receiving that referral, oftentimes faster. And then they do a search at various links. You know, it depends on when they've located housing that meets their needs and they're qualified for. Typically we see within 60 days that those youth get leased up. And then as I mentioned, they get the 3 years of housing stabilization services. Another initiative that we're working on is encouraging all of our youth to enroll in our family self-sufficiency program, which all voucher holders are eligible for. But for youth in particular, it helps extend their housing assistance. Youth get 36 months of housing assistance. It's different than our other populations. But they get a 24-month extension if they enroll in family self-sufficiency. So we're really proactively engaging our youth to get that maximum 60 months of housing assistance. In addition, then they get the additional supports of the family self-sufficiency program to increase their income, build savings in an escrow account. So there's kind of that wraparound services.
That's great, thank you. Anybody else have questions? Thank you so much, Rebecca.
All right, thank you.
Okay, would you like to introduce us next?
Absolutely. Again, Julia Bidwell, Executive Director, Orange County Housing Authority, Director of OCHCD. Next, for Community Development, is our new Community Development Analyst. We met him 2 months ago, so Frank Padilla is going to give the report this morning.
All right, thank you. Good morning. As Julia mentioned, my name is Frank Padilla, and I work in the community development area. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about at your last meeting, Craig was here and he alluded or mentioned to you that that our office was working on the annual action plan. There's a process that all governments, local governments that receive funding from HUD have to go through in order to secure that funding. And having been a former HUD employee, it's a process that I'm somewhat familiar with, I guess I would say. But one of the things that's required, as Craig mentioned to you last time he came before you, is that the office was working on the annual action plan. What the annual action plan does, it lays out the projects that the county is proposing to fund before it goes to the Board of Supervisors. and have the pleasure of reporting to you that we completed the annual action plan that we were working on last time. And Julia will be presenting it to the Board of Supervisors next week on April 28th. It's approximately $5.9 million that are being allocated in that annual action plan. About $3.4 to CDBG, $1.2 million to the home program, and approximately $302,000 to the ESG program. And that's being dispersed through 14 different communities and two internal different agencies that administer a couple programs for the county. And the projects that are being funded that are identified in that annual action plan include four projects in public service, three projects that are housing rehab, seven projects that are public facilities, and two that are going to the metro cities that we work with. And so once the Board of Supervisors approves that, our next phase in implementing that is to go through and begin to work on co-op agreements that HUD requires us to have with all the participating cities that are part of the urban county. And so we'll begin to immediately focus and put together those co-op agreements. HUD requires us to renew those every 3 years. And so that's kind of our next big project that we have in our particular office. And so again, that's in a nutshell what we've been working on for like since last time I was here before you and as an attendee. And so if any of you have any questions, I certainly would entertain them.
Thank you and welcome, Frank. Anybody have any questions for Frank?
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much. Okay, we have another presentation, and I can introduce because we know her. Michelle Sadiba is our housing development manager. Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, commissioners. So I'll do a report out based on any new updates that I have since the last time we met. We haven't had a project review advisory panel meeting since our last meeting. Our next one actually is today after this meeting, and we're hoping to bring forward two requests to the prep for consideration, one of which is additional funding requests for Avon River, which is a home key project that is under construction right now, looking for additional capital financing to finish construction. And the second is Tustin Heritage Apartments, which is in the city of Tustin, and it is a small project brought forward by Families Forward and only requesting project-based vouchers. So that would be after this meeting here. We still have our notice of funding availability open. So far, we have not received a lot of applications, one for additional funding requests, but we have received a lot of inquiries, so we do anticipate at some point in time we probably will have a influx of applications coming in. Seems like that's typically how it goes. And in terms of events, we do have an upcoming grand opening event for the Orion Senior Apartments in the city of Orange. That's scheduled for 11 a.m. on Wednesday, May 13th. All of you should have received a email invitation. If not, please check your spam or quarantine boxes. I realized mine was stuck in there as well too, so I had to go in there and release it. But that should be a very nice event. It's a large scale project. However, there's only 8 permanent supportive housing units in that project, which we project based. And I think that's it for my updates. If there's any questions.
Anybody have any questions for Michelle? Great, thank you, Michelle.
Great, thank you so much.
Okay, and that now I'll turn it over to you, Julia.
Certainly, Julia Bidwell, Executive Director, Secretary to the Commission. I'm reporting out that we did attended the 55th Annual Apartment Association of Orange County Trade Show on March 19th. Attending events like the trade show provides OCHA the opportunity to engage with the community, share information about our program, and obtain feedback. We will be bringing a presentation to you all to show you highlights from that event at a future meeting. You will notice you all have voting forms in front of you. Some of you came early to the meeting. We have our annual poster contest, and we have to submit by grade category entries by May 1st to narrow First, it goes to sort of a Southwest narrow group. They narrow down the submissions then to national narrow. We received fewer. We extended the timeline quite a few times, but the quality is fantastic. And if you take the time to read the stories, that's always the best as well. And then hopefully, like last time, we will invite the kids to a meeting. Usually it's better if they're out of school. I believe we did June last year, so we anticipate that we'll invite them to attend and give them awards, take photos. So please vote if you haven't already and hand them to Jessica, or she'll collect them at the end of the meeting. That's all I have for today, unless you have any questions for me.
Thank you very much, Julia. So at this time, it's member comments or remarks. Anybody have anything they would like to share? All right, seeing none, we will adjourn at, what time is this?
10:44.
10:44. And our next meeting is on May 21st. Thank you, everyone.